Rockingham Social Service District, Ms. James, and I understand the appellee has waived. Pardon?
The guardian did not.
Okay, and you are, sir?
Andrew Harding.
I'm sorry, I've got that here. And guardian ad litem. And you signed on with Department of Social Services on brief?
Yes, sir.
So I guess you've got their whole time. Ms. James, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 3 minutes.
Okay. You may begin when you're ready.
If you may please the court, I'm Shelley James, and I'm here on behalf of Laurel Ansel, who is the biological mother of two little girls who were removed from her care and whose parental rights were eventually terminated by an order of the Harrisonburg-Rockingham Circuit Court. We've raised two issues on appeal, one being an evidentiary issue and one being a sufficiency issue. I'll start.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment, because I have a question about the evidentiary issue.
Mm-hmm.
I understand you're contesting the Community Services Board reports coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Are you also contesting challenging the admission of Dr. Grayson's parental evaluation?
No, we specifically agreed to the admission of that record. I will tell you the trial was getting rather long, and I had Dr. Grayson in court before, and we all agreed we would just admit her report.
Thank you.
I do recognize that it relies in part on the CSB records, but we specifically admitted it, not including the hearsay in that document, except as to a reason why she made her conclusions.
Let me bring up what I think is probably your toughest row to hoe, and that is, even if these records of her initial TDO admission were improperly admitted, why weren't they just harmless in light of the totality of the evidence that was presented concerning her parenting ability?
Because, Your Honor, these records were particularly strong, as I'm sure the department felt, that she was just crazy and out of control and a danger to herself and her children, whereas there are other records that showed, certainly talked about her admission, and we concede she was admitted to the hospital, but she was not admitted on the first day. They actually found that she didn't meet their standards. And
wasn't there substantial evidence that she had mental health issues?
There was, Your
Honor. That impaired her ability to adequately parent?
We do not agree that those issues, you then say, led to her inability to adequately parent. Certainly, that's part of our sufficiency argument. There are people with mental health issues who can be very good parents, and there was evidence in this case that she had good visits with the children. The time when the visits started to deteriorate was when the Department of Social Services decided that they would restrict the visits or change the visits to every other week.
Ms. James, what specific information in the CSB documents didn't come in one form or another from some other source? On brief, you make a reference to the CSB documents revealing a positive test for amphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding of the record is there are multiple other sources of information to demonstrate that she tested on more than one occasion, positive for amphetamines. And so I guess I'm getting at kind of the on the harmless error side, if the same type of information, the same information was in front of the fact finder otherwise.
And, Your Honor, that is where some of the problem develops here. The CSB records say she had a positive test for amphetamines. Well, is that the test that came from the hospital, where the records specifically say that this test is not valid for any use other than for medical purposes? And if that's the case, then that test should not have been used in a court, and the court should not have considered it as proof that she had been
Which test was that? That wasn't part of the original records that you're objecting to, was it?
I don't know, because CSB record, because we don't, they obviously did not have firsthand information of this, we don't know what test they're referring to.
Well, right, but my question is, okay, let's eliminate the CSB test, CSB record, it never comes in, okay? One of the things that you objected to it saying was this positive test for amphetamines.
Mm-hmm.
But if the CSB record is never in, my understanding of the record is there are other references in the record that no one's objecting to that demonstrate that she on occasion had tested positive for amphetamines.
If I remember correctly, I think once.
Okay. So the fact that she tested positive for amphetamines was already in the record, so the fact that it was in the CSB record and may have been the same test, we don't know, doesn't demonstrate any harm from that portion of the CSB record coming in. So my question is, can you point me to something in the CSB record that doesn't show up anywhere else?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with your phrase that it's not prejudicial for that reason, because if we know there's one test that was positive for amphetamines and we know the date of that, that says one thing. But if we have one that we know and another one that we have no idea if it's a new one or a second one, certainly a second test for amphetamines is significant. It creates a lot more significance to a drug issue than just one test.
But don't these records simply relate to the reason why the children were taken, removed? They don't have anything to do with the mother's situation at the time the court decided to terminate.
They do, Your Honor. They do have something to do with why the court decided to terminate, because the court looked at these as this is how she was, this is how she continues to be. That's what the department had to prove, that she hadn't remedied the conditions. And the department kept pointing to these and pointed to these records as evidence that this is what she is like today.
Yeah, but that's where I'm having a problem. I agree with you that the court considered those as a reason for why the child was found to be abused and neglected and taken into DSS picked the children up. But the other evidence, the ongoing evidence of is what the court considered in determining whether that mental health condition still existed.
I think the court also considered this evidence, Your Honor, that they looked at this and the judge looked at this and said, you know, she had this condition back then. She was paranoid, as these records specifically use that word, and she continued to be paranoid. As to your question, Your Honor, for example, there on page 399 of the record, which is very close to the beginning of the CSB documents, there's a whole big paragraph that talks about a contact note from March of 2017 and says that my client said she felt people were watching her house, driving around her house, that her daughter could either communicate with dead people or with people trying to get into the house. That's the only place that this kind of thing is. Or if it's repeated, it's repeated because they got it from these records.
Well, Dr. Grayson says in her report that when she's talking about your client, she says that if the hospitalization did not result from substance abuse, then a diagnosis in the schizophrenia spectrum is indicated, which would seem to indicate some, you know, either one or the other or both, any of which would be pretty impactful, I would think, on her ability to parent.
And I can understand that, except for the rest of Dr. Grayson's report, which says that she's a low risk for child abuse, says that she's intelligent, said that she did well on the parenting evaluation test. And while she said in one place that she thought that my client had an overinflated impression of one of her children's, I believe, of Kenley's abilities, and remember she hadn't seen the children in a while and she was only seeing them for about a couple of hours every month, she was right on point, basically, in her evaluation of Hunter. And Dr. Grayson had never met either of these children. So her impression of my client's evaluation needs to be, as far as that was concerned, needed to be taken with a grain of salt. So,
what is the court allowed to, given that the standard is, has the condition been remedied over time? If the court can't consider the CSB information, how does the court conduct the inquiry to see if the situation has been remedied over time, if the CSB information is what establishes the baseline, the reason that they went into care?
There might be information that is based on things that happened at the CSB that would be admissible, but this is not it. This is an abuse of the business records doctrine. And I am happy that the Melick decision was quoted in the appellee's brief, because I think that's an example of where people did the exactly right thing to get their evidence admitted. They proved that the people who had the information recorded the information, and there was no problem with the information taken from that record. Here, their own custodian could not testify as to whether the people who inputted this information had any firsthand knowledge.
I think the appellee's brief at least stuck out to me as not recognizing the fact that we have effectively adopted the federal rule of evidence regarding business records and gotten away from the old shop book rule that we used to rely on. Mm-hmm. But let me ask this, but you're running low on time, and I want to get your response. If we agree with you on the evidentiary issue, and if we agree that it's not harmless, do we have to reach the sufficiency, or can we just remand it back for retrial? I know in a criminal case, the rules are quite different because of the double jeopardy clause, mm-hmm. but I see no reason why we couldn't send this back to the judge and said, take another look at this without these records, or at least make sure that they come into evidence in a proper way.
I quite honestly had not considered that question, Your Honor. Given most of my background in appellate work is in criminal, I had assumed you would have to go to the sufficiency question.
Because
and especially
the problem is that the child is now different than she was when this case was originally heard, just in terms of age.
Right.
And it always is a best interest of the child determination in the end it controls, and that best interest may be different now than it was.
And that's what I was thinking also, Your Honor. It might not be the case in other civil cases, but in cases involving the custody and visitation of children, as you know, final orders are never really final. And so I think you may be correct. I'm not sure. I'd have to think it through a little more. But it certainly seems that would be appropriate. And certainly we could put on additional evidence. The department could put on additional evidence. There may be evidence at this point that this termination was harmful to these children, that they missed their mother, that they missed their father. That could certainly be the case. We just don't know.
All right. Thank you. I'll put a little time back on the clock because I stepped on you a little bit. Mr. Harding?
Afternoon,
Mr. Harding, I know your scope of representation is a little different as guardian ad litem. Are you preparing to address the evidentiary issue, or are you simply going to talk about what you perceive to be the best interest of the children?
I will address the evidentiary issue because I am supporting the termination in this matter. May it please the court, I'm Andrew Harding, GAL for these two children, and I think there was a mention on the record, I'm also GAL for the half-children as well, the two other half-children that were placed with relatives, incidentally. Those four children are not in mother's house because of rampant mental health and drug issues that lasted years before the removal of these two children and were not remedied within the time required by statute. We cited in our brief Toms versus Hanover that 283C2 does not require this huge magnitude of problem, but that they fail to make a reasonable change within that time period. So the argument by appellee that, oh, well, these CSB records say it's a mountain when it's a molehill, don't negate the fact that just a molehill would be a reason for termination.
But if you need the records to establish whether it's a mountain or a molehill, that's the main thrust of their argument.
And I would agree, and I would disagree. The record is replete with mental health, beginning at least in 2014, at time of removal in 2017, up until the date of termination. And I was puzzling over how I could illustrate how replete the record is, and yesterday I finally came up with it. The records in question cover from JA 394 through 420. Those are the pages of the records. I went through appellee's brief and appellant's brief and looked for those references. In appellee's brief and the joint GAL brief, we referenced those page numbers once, only once, and it was talking about secession of services from 14 to 17. In appellant's brief, it was cited six times, and of those, five were a string cite. That is, yes, the CSB records were cited, but it was cross-referenced with other parts of the record which are not objected to.
But the objected to records established the condition that led to the foster care placement. Correct?
One component. But I think the basis of removal would be sustained even if we excise those records.
But the statute requires the parent to remedy the condition which led to removal. And if we don't know, if those records are erroneously admitted, we don't know the condition that led to removal, we're going to have a hard time deciding whether that condition was remedied or not.
I think a good baseline to determine the basis of removal is the affidavit. I don't recall maybe the CSB records were referenced in part of that. But the basis of removal was, number one, there was no heat in the house because mom was in a fight with her father. Number two, there was something strange that happened that led to a stool being thrown out the second story window and her talking to people on the second floor. Number three, she was not physically available because she'd been TDO'd because of that incident. And number four, there was an independent history of mental health, including that notorious time a few years back where she was wandering through the Pineville Cemetery. All of those stand alone as a basis for removal, even if you excise the CSB records that are a bone of contention.
But it was that TDO that initiated all of this. Mm-hmm. And the children were actually removed because they had no place to go because mom was being TDO'd.
Yes.
So again, that's the basis for removal.
Well, I think.
And then there's, yeah, you know, there's obviously a continued need for removal, mm-hmm, based on some of these other factors that you have mentioned. But that original basis for removal is relevant to establishing the baseline that had to be corrected.
I would agree that it's useful to establish the baseline, but I think we need to draw a distinction. The mental health, you know, the special justice that TDO'd Ms. Ansel is not subject to Rule 2803, okay? A TDO is a fact of a reality in this record, and in effect proving that there was a basis for removal is not necessary. She was not available at that time.
But she was TDO'd, but then if the only thing that caused her to be removed was a TDO, without any reference to the underlying condition that necessitated the TDO, once the T part, the temporary part of the detention order is over, she's available again.
Yes, she is, but what I guess that begs the question, what led to her being TDO'd in the first place?
It does. And so my question is, absent the CSB record that's being challenged as being improperly admitted, is there any place I can look at in the record to know the basis of the TDO without looking at the CSB record? In other words, is it available in the record without the the CSB records.
Her bizarre discussions about what happened, and again, her history, which again is not necessarily within the CSB records. Remember, the CSB records were only used to show after the fact that she went to CSB, she flaked out of CSB. She went to CSB, she flaked out of CSB. She was TDO'd because of her bizarre behavior, her bizarre discussions at that particular moment. And that stands alone. I think that does raise a very interesting big picture question. You don't get your termination of parental rights just for being TDO'd once, okay? I mean, that's why we provide people the opportunity to fix the problem under 283C2. She was terminated, and the kids were removed because of that history of mental health that did not just spring up at one moment in 2017. She had been TDO'd before,
but
she had this.
But that's exactly what's in the records that are being challenged, isn't it?
That's one element of it. But we have on the record that she was TDO'd in 2014 because I'll just call it the Pineville Cemetery incident. We have on the record. Her taking that Grotto's fire department truck. We have on the record her behavior and the positive drug screens on probation. All that is during that time period that the CSB records that's objected to is in place, and that's why this TDO in 2017 was of such significance that DSS removed it at that point.
Go ahead.
Hypothetically, assume that there is no evidence was admitted showing exactly why she was TDO'd and the children were removed. Not this case, hypothetical case. If that is the case, can the department ever meet its burden? Because it's its burden to show that the situation hasn't been remedied, not her burden to show that she's remedied the situation. So if we never have a baseline established, the department can never win, correct? And I know you're not the department.
Viewed in that hypothetical, I would say yes in that big picture thing. But I think CSB records or not, I think we can point a finger on why the basis of removal was and why the basis of removal was not remedied. It was mental health.
Weren't there also significant drug issues
yes.
in terms of denial of drug use despite positive screens, failure to appear for drug treatment, failure to appear for counseling treatment, failure to schedule a parenting evaluation?
Exactly, Your Honor. And again, that's part of the problem when we got to the Grayson evaluation finally after this long saga. We still don't know what the problem is. Is it drugs? Is it mental health? Is it intermixed? But what we did know was in 2017, at the time of removal for these kids, there was something not right.
Was that when there was no heat as well in 2017?
Yes, exactly. That was the same time period. And Your Honor recalls why there was no heat. Well, there's the argument to say that it has nothing to do with her mental health, there was some sort of family drama where Dad said, well, I'm not going to pay for it when she's not paying anything for the house. I'm not going to surmise why that family drama happened, but that gives an indication that there was something manifesting at that time period underneath the surface, along with everything else, that necessitated the removal at that point.
Mr. Harding, we've kind of skipped over, I think, the initial issue, and I'd like to go back and pick up on it, and that is whether the records were admissible in the first instance. The testimony of Jeanine Turner, is on page 70 of the appendix. And her testimony basically is, these are the records that I provided. These are the records that we sent. I can tell you what the title of each document is, but I can't tell you what the content is of each document. And she doesn't know who put the information into the record. She simply knows that these are their records. How in the world does that meet the requirements of 2:8036?
Well, Your Honor recalls that this was on cross-examination by appellant's counsel. If we turn back to page 69 at line 3 through 7, it talks about the standard procedure within the organization itself that I think talks about the contemporaneous actions which meet, as Your Honor said, the old shopbook rule in that regard. The cross-examination was sort of picking apart, as it were, but does not negate what was said on page 69. Also, we have
where does she testify who made these records and why they were made?
I think
And whether they were kept, whether they were made in the regular course of the business of the CSB.
If we turn to page 73, there's my inartful cross-examination talking about the normal practice at the beginning of the end for people typing this out is to make accurate records. If they don't enter records, it's supposed to be a fair, you know, again, I would have preferred to have phrase it better, but the whole point is we enter these records to treat people, just like any other shop book's role is to keep records. And I would, of course, defer to this panel, especially as to the Mellick decision. But if we look to footnote 4.
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
I'm going to defer as to that. But footnote 4 of that very well-written opinion talks about the ultimate reliability of business records is established by the business reliance on the records. That's why the cross-examination I had.
But the rule, and this was met in Mellick, the rule requires that the record be made at or near the time of the acts by or from information transmitted by someone with knowledge. There is no evidence in this record as to who made these records.
I used the hypothetical, I think, on page Joint Appendix 411, as opposed to going through the whole record, of saying there's an entrant, there's a present sense impression, and again, there's very good cross-examination.
But the records can't authenticate themselves. The custodian of the record has to authenticate them.
The custodian has to say these are the agency's records. And again, that's the import of Ms. Gutterman's questioning on direct, as opposed to the cross-examination of Ms. James, talking about agency keeps contemporaneously with the patient.
Well, one of the things that I think is present in Mellick that's not present here was even though they couldn't identify who actually entered the information, it was known that the information was collected by whoever took the person's picture at the time of the transaction.
Yes.
Because that was key, and that was almost established that by in and of itself, because by definition, to take the person's photograph, you had to be present when the photograph was taken. That's kind of how that works. Is there anything even remotely like that with the CSV?
I think
this could have been done. Somebody could have scribbled this down 6 months later, couldn't they? Or are they dated? Are they signed?
I think that's the import on page 69, line 3 through 4. Records that your agency keeps contemporaneously when it sees a patient, either during the patient contact or right after.
The agency doesn't create the records. A person creates the records.
Well, this court commonly uses the term the Commonwealth says. Well, it's not the Commonwealth, it's the Attorney General's office.
But you have to establish that the record was made by someone with knowledge. That means to me a person.
The agency keeps it contemporaneously. And again, an agency works through, well, its agents. That is the person there.
And does
present.
The agency have knowledge? Is there testimony that the federal, there's a lot of cases on the federal rule. And I haven't seen any of them that allow someone just to come in and say, you know, these are our agency's records that we keep. If it's a bank, these are the teller's records that are made when a transaction is done at the bank or something to that effect, something to tell us what they are or tell a trial court what they are.
And I would agree if it just says these are our records, undated, we don't know where in the ether it came from, that would be a different point. This is not the perfect case, I admit it, but agency kept contemporaneously at patient contact or right after. I'm quoting straight from the question that was asked by DSS counsel in that particular case. Would have preferred to have it a little sharper, but I think that suffices.
I mean, what you're missing is the next question, by somebody who had the patient contact.
Yes, during the patient contact or right after.
See, the or right after creates the possibility that it's being recorded by somebody who wasn't present at the contact.
I think that would be a valid concern if we didn't have, in effect, a caption of, and I forgot the exact phrase, at the top of everything, you know, basically the source. And that's why I used on the brief the example of one thing where you have...
But that's in the records themselves.
Yes, exactly.
Can the records authenticate themselves?
No, they cannot. But they can give an indication of the contemporaneousness of something or that something happened on a particular date. I can look at my calendar, and it says Lexington, 2 p.m. That is not, you know, that is not self-authenticating, but we can look at the context of some record, like the court's calendar for today, and give an indication of what was happening at 2 o'clock in this particular courtroom.
All right, you're winding down. You want to conclude your argument?
Are there any further questions? I will conclude.
Thank you very much. Very nice. Ms. James, we didn't really ask you a lot of questions about the records. What's your response to Mr. Harding's argument that they meet the requirements of Rule 2803?
Your Honor, I think it's clear they do not, and I think Mr. Harding realizes
Why?
They do not. Because using words like people and agency does not tell you that the specific person who had knowledge of this information is the one who recorded it.
Why isn't it a reasonable inference, given that there was testimony that they are recorded at the time or immediately after a patient contact? Doesn't that at least suggest, maybe not sufficiently, but doesn't it at least suggest that the person writing down the information was the person who had the contact?
That's not what that says at all. What it said is these records are records that your agency keeps contemporaneously when it sees a patient, either during the patient contact or right after. Does your agency write down what has transpired, make those records close in time to the interaction with the patient? Yes.
Okay.
Does
that establish the timing requirement at or near the time?
Yes. We did not argue that position, Your Honor. But what it doesn't establish is who writes down this information and then who records it.
Well, and help me here, because I'm thinking back, but I was under the impression that these records are not all patient records, that there's records of police or sheriff's department contact. There's a lot of things in there that don't relate directly or don't come from the patient.
And Your Honor, I actually put a box around my writing down of what appellant's counsel or the GAL said, because these were not records to treat this person. There's nothing in these records about treating her. There's about how they want to get a TDO. There's a record of a phone call from her brother. There are all sorts of things in here, but these are not treatment records. These are intake records from the Community Services Board and some other random records from the Community Services Board. They are not records of people who were providing medical treatment to my client. And Judge Russell, I did go through quickly to see if I could come up with a couple of places where there is different information in these records, and I would refer you to 400 of the appendix, where it says that my client began meth use at the age of 17 and opiates at age 24. I would refer you to page 402, where it said she had little insight and impaired judgment, which is certainly something that I believe the fact that she had a TDO suggested, but there was also a refusal to grant a TDO on the day just before. So I think that statement is independently prejudicial. On page 406, it talks about how she lost custody of her other two children when they were young, which I realized the guardian ad litem just mentioned to Your Honors, but I don't believe that was something that really came up anywhere else in the court case. It also mentions there that she has a family history of drug abuse, at least as far as this is saying that other members of her family have drug abuse, and I don't believe that has ever came up in any other section of the record. On page 409, it talks about how her brother says that he doesn't think a short-term TDO is sufficient. And those were just a couple of places I was able to find in the 15 minutes that counsel had to argue.
Understood.
Thank you very much for your argument. We will greet counsel, and then we'll take up Fleischer versus Commonwealth.